Picture for a moment a small open plan office somewhere in San Francisco, late on a Tuesday night. Most of the desks are empty. The overhead lights are off. The only illumination comes from a single monitor at the far end of the room, where one engineer is sitting alone, staring at a chart. The chart shows latency, the time it takes for the company's chat service to respond to a request. There are two lines on the chart. The first line, in soft gray, is the past. It is jagged. It has tall spikes that reach upward at regular intervals, every few minutes, like a heart monitor with an arrhythmia. Each one of those spikes represents a moment when the service paused, when users somewhere in the world felt a small hesitation when they tried to send a message, when the engineers got paged because the alert thresholds got crossed. The spikes had been there for years. They were, by then, almost a fact of life. The second line, in soft green, is the present. It is flat. Not perfectly flat, but flat in a way that the first line is not. The spikes are simply gone. There is no jagged top, no regular interruption, no heart monitor pattern of pauses every few minutes. The engineer has been staring at it for almost an hour, occasionally refreshing the dashboard, occasionally zooming in to make sure the chart is correct, because the chart looks like a lie. It looks like something that was supposed to take years of incremental optimization, and that should have produced, at best, a modest improvement, and that has, instead, simply made the problem go away. Disappear. The thing that had been there since the company was founded is now not there anymore. The team that produced this result did exactly one thing. They rewrote a single service from one programming language into another. The first language had a garbage collector that ran in the background, doing the bookkeeping I told you about a few episodes ago. The second language did not. The rewrite is what made the spikes disappear. The engineer is staring at the chart because it is, in a quiet way, one of the most significant things she has seen all year. And the company she works for is called Discord. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 5, Why Rust is Winning. Today, I want to walk you through the part of the story that comes after the one we told last time. Last time, we ended on Mozilla's quiet release of Rust 1.0 in May of 2015 and on the wider world's almost complete indifference to it. Today, we follow what happened next. We follow the slow buildup of interest, and then the inflection point, and then the cascade that put Rust inside every major technology company in the world, including the ones whose entire business depended on not making mistakes. By the end of the episode, you will understand, with real data, why the people who work on serious software keep saying that something has shifted, and you will understand why this matters even if you have never written a line of code yourself. The story is, in the end, a story about which kinds of software get built next and who gets to build them. Let me back up a little because the start of this story is quiet, and the quiet part is important. In the first few years after Rust 1.0 shipped, most of the world's serious software engineers looked at it, found the strict borrow checker frustrating, found the famous error messages alarming, and went back to whatever they had been using. There were a handful of curious early adopters, mostly in the open source community. There were enthusiasts on the internet who wrote blog posts about the language with the kind of intensity that made people who did not use it slightly uncomfortable. There were companies that took small experimental steps. None of this looked at the time like an avalanche. It looked like a marginal language that some people were very excited about and that the rest of the industry was politely ignoring. What changed very slowly was that the few companies that did try Rust started reporting back something the rest of the industry could not ignore. They were not reporting that Rust was easier to write. They were reporting that the software they built with it was different in kind. It was steadier. It did not crash. It did not pause. It used less memory. It used less electricity. When they took a service they had written in a more forgiving language and rewrote it in Rust, the rewrite tended to be faster, smaller, and more predictable in a way that was not just a marginal improvement. It was, in many cases, a different category of result. That is the part nobody in the language design world had quite predicted, and it is the part that, once the numbers became public, turned the curiosity into a wave. Let me give you the inflection points. These are the moments, in roughly chronological order, when a wave became visible. In 2020, Amazon Web Services announced two things almost back-to-back. The first was Firecracker, a tiny operating system that runs every call to a service called Lambda. Every time anyone, anywhere in the world, runs a function on Lambda, a Firecracker instance starts up, runs the function, and shuts down. Firecracker is, by some measures, the busiest piece of software in the world. It is written in Rust. The second was Bottle Rocket, an operating system for hosting container workloads, also written in Rust. Amazon is not in the habit of publishing experiments. When they ship something at this scale, they have already tested it for years internally, and they have made a long-term commitment. The choice of Rust for both of these was the moment serious infrastructure teams started paying attention. A year later, Cloudflare, the company that sits between the open internet and a very large fraction of the world's websites, published a paper about a piece of software called Pingora. Cloudflare had, for years, been running the open source web server Nginx, written in C, to handle their traffic. Nginx is mature, fast, battle-tested. It is also the kind of software where a memory bug can become a global outage. Cloudflare's engineers, after years of nursing it, rewrote the entire thing from scratch in Rust. They named the new version Pingora. Pingora now serves, as of recent reports, over a trillion requests every day. That is more requests per day than most countries have residents. It is one of the largest pieces of infrastructure on the public internet, and it is one of the largest deployments of Rust in production anywhere. Around the same time, the engineer in our cold open was discovering, at Discord, that rewriting their read state service from a language called Go into Rust simply made their tail latency spikes disappear. They wrote a blog post about it. The chart from that blog post became famous in engineering circles. Many other companies looked at that chart and quietly started planning their own rewrites. Microsoft began publicly rewriting components of the Windows kernel in Rust around the same period. They did not announce this in a single splashy press release. They mentioned it in passing in technical talks. Anyone who was paying attention noticed. The team responsible for the security of the most widely used desktop operating system in the world had decided that the language they had relied on for decades was not the right tool anymore, and that the replacement was Rust. Around the same time, Google reported that the proportion of memory safety vulnerabilities in new Android code dropped sharply as the share of Rust in the code base grew. And then, in 2022, the thing happened that, more than any other single event, marked the change. The Linux kernel, the piece of software that sits underneath nearly every cloud server, every Android phone, every internet router, every embedded device of any complexity, accepted Rust as its second programming language. Until that moment, the Linux kernel had been written exclusively in C for more than 30 years, since the project began in 1991. The Linux kernel community is famously conservative. Linus Torvalds, the founder, is famously direct in his rejection of changes he does not like. The acceptance of Rust into the kernel was not a small experiment. It was a long debate conducted in public on a mailing list everyone could read, and at the end of it, the kernel community agreed that this language, alone among all the languages of the last 30 years, had earned a place alongside C in the operating system that runs most of the modern world. Once the Linux kernel said yes, the conversation in the rest of the industry shifted permanently. The question stopped being whether Rust was real and started being which parts of the company should be on it next. I want to give you one more piece of evidence because it is harder to dismiss than any of the company's stories. Every year, an enormous online community of programmers called Stack Overflow runs a developer survey and asks tens of thousands of working software engineers across every industry, what language they love most. For 8 years in a row, the answer to that question has been Rust. Not the most used, the most loved, the language that the people who actually have to live with it report enjoying. That is, in its own way, a sign that something is genuinely working, because there are not many products of any kind that the people who use them every day will keep on calling their favorite, year after year, for almost a decade. That brings us to today. The list of major companies that now run Rust in production reads almost like a list of the entire technology industry. Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Meta, Cloudflare, Discord, Dropbox, Figma, 1Password, Hugging Face. A new generation of developer tools called things like RipGrep and Ruff and UV, written in Rust, that are routinely 50 to 100 times faster than the older tools they replaced. A new generation of data engines called things like Polars and Data Fusion and Sail that handle data workloads at speeds the older systems could not reach. The whole of the modern internet has quietly, in less than a decade, picked up this language and started rewriting the parts of itself that most needed to stop pausing, stop crashing, stop leaking. There is a separate angle of this story that deserves its own moment, and that is what happened in the world of artificial intelligence. Most of the work of training large language models, the kind that produce text and answer questions and write code, happens in Python. Python is where the libraries are, where the researchers live, where the experimentation happens. But once a model is trained and you want to actually run it to serve it to millions of users, every millisecond of latency and every byte of memory begins to matter. That is the part of the work that has moved steadily into Rust. Hugging Face, the company that has become the central library of open source artificial intelligence, writes the tokenizers, which is the layer that turns text into numbers the model can read, in Rust. Several of the leading inference engines, the systems that actually run a model and produce its output, are written in Rust. The pattern is that Python builds the model and Rust serves it, and that division of labor is, increasingly, the standard arrangement at companies serving large amounts of artificial intelligence traffic. The same pattern has shown up in developer tooling, in a way that is genuinely visible to anyone who writes code for a living. A search tool called RipGrep, written by a single engineer in his spare time, replaced an older tool that had been the standard for decades, simply by being 10 to 100 times faster. A Python linter called Ruff, written in Rust, runs hundreds of times faster than the Python written linters it replaced. A Python package installer called UV, also written in Rust, made what used to take a minute take less than a second. None of these were marketed. They spread because anyone who used them once could feel the difference immediately, and the difference was not small. The pattern of a Rust tool eating the lunch of the older tool in its category has become so common in the last few years that engineers now half-jokingly check whether someone has written a Rust replacement for whatever slow tool they are using. It did not happen because anyone marketed it well. It happened because the deal Rust offered, the deal Mozilla had committed to in 2015, turned out to be real. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that Rust adoption was slow at the start, almost invisible for the first 5 years, and then it became an avalanche because the early adopters reported back results that the rest of the industry could not ignore. The second is that the inflection points, Amazon's Firecracker, Cloudflare's Pingora, Discord's tail latency rewrite, Microsoft inside Windows, the Linux kernel saying yes after 30 years, and the 8-year streak of programmers naming it their favorite language, together amount to one of the largest shifts in serious software in a generation. The third is that none of this happened because of marketing. It happened because the language did what it said it would do, and the numbers came in. Next time on Rust, gently, we will tell the other side of the story. Not where Rust wins, but where it does not. There are kinds of software for which Rust is genuinely the wrong choice, and being honest about that is the only way to keep your trust. We will walk through what Rust is good at and what it is not good at, and how to tell the difference when you are looking at a project of your own. Until then, Take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.